More about. Let's finish the workshop with chapter three, more about alcoholism. So this chapter outlines why I need to come to OA. It describes the mental twist, and I think the first three paragraphs of this chapter are really, really critical. And if I read them in the first person for me, I think they are really, really powerful. So I'm just going to do that. So I have been unwilling to admit that I am a real compulsive overeater. I do not like to think that I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that my eating career has been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that I could eat like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my binge foods is my great obsession. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. I will pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. I learned that I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I am a compulsive overeater. This is my first step in recovery. The delusion that I am like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. I am a person who has lost the ability to control eating certain foods. We know that no real compulsive overeater ever recovers control, so I am never going to recover control as a real compulsive overeater. I feel that at times I am regaining control, such as when I go on a diet, but such intervals, usually brief, are inevitably followed by still less control, which leads in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I am like a person who is in the grip of a progressive illness because I am a chronic compulsive overeater. And over any considerable period, I am going to get worse, not better. So again, some really good reflections. You know, do I accept I am bodily and mentally different? You've shared about that. Have I had countless vain attempts to eat like other people? Am I obsessed with the thought that somehow, someday, I will be able to eat like a non-compulsive overeater? And I pursued this delusion to the point where I was killing myself with food. And when I was controlling my food, I wasn't enjoying it. And when I was enjoying my food, I wasn't controlling it. And that part where it talks about conceding to my innermost self has to be in that really quiet, deep place within me, not in a room full of others or to my sponsor, because I think that's what she wants to hear. It has to be a gut level experience. And as I said earlier, this gets harder the longer we're in recovery because my life improves drastically after a few months and I start to feel better. So I can never forget who I am. And if I am a real compulsive overeater, then I will never regain control. I might have brief periods, but then I lose control again and it gets worse and worse each time. And the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization I felt at yet another failure was horrendous, especially after that excitement that it was going to be different this time. It was going to be better. I was going to do it. Every failure just chipped away at my self-esteem little by little. And my experience is that my disease got worse over time, never better. And that's certainly my experience in relapse, as I shared before. And as I said, I tried every imaginable remedy, and I even went back to those remedies in relapse, absolutely knowing that they did not work. And it says on page 31, by every form of self-deception and experimentation, I will try to prove myself an exception to the rule, therefore not a compulsive overeater. And what my ego does, it tries and proves that I am not a compulsive overeater and I don't belong in OA. And it does that by putting a distance, a judgment between me and other compulsive overeaters. And a speaker I listen to talks about our ego has three functions. One, make me right. Two, make me different. Three, make me feel good right now. And my ego thinks that those things will keep me safe. And that's why working the steps is so critical, because they reduce my ego, and step 10 and 11 keep it right sized. And then the middle of page 31, you know, heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to eat like other people. You know, how long have you been trying? What methods have you tried? Does your ego try to convince you you're not a personal, you're not a compulsive overeater? You know, what's your personal identification with the first three paragraphs? And then we're given some practical stories. And the first one is called A Man of 30. And in this story, it talks about no matter how long we are recovered, if we are a compulsive overeater, we will never be able to return to our former ways of eating. This man puts all his efforts into stopping, and he couldn't. And I don't decide when this is over because the disease controls me, because I have no power. It doesn't matter how long I've been abstinent, the size of my body bears no resemblance to the size of my drinking. And on page 33, there's a really powerful warning. And it says, if I'm going to personalize this, if I am planning to stop compulsive overeating, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday I will be immune to certain foods. And I was working with a sponsee a couple of years back, and they looked up the definition of lurking. And one of the definitions was remaining hidden so as to wait in ambush, in a latent state, but still presenting a threat. And I just think that is an absolutely brilliant interpretation of what happens in our disease, and not having that notion, that lurking notion that I can return to my former ways of eating. I must have no reservations whatsoever about returning to compulsive overeating. No reservation, no lurking notion. And then on page 34, it says, whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not, have that first bite or not. This is the baffling feature of compulsive overeating as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. And I had the necessity because I was really, really damaging my health, but that wasn't enough to make me stop. And I had the wish, you know, the number of binges I had where I was, you know, just crying because I didn't want to eat the food that I was eating. I had the necessity and the wish, and I couldn't stop. And then page 35 starts off Jim's story, which again is a fabulous story and contains many, many valuable lessons. And what I hear in Jim's story, a little bit like me in my first recovery, is Jim failed to enlarge his spiritual life. He also had a lot of self-knowledge, and he knew what would happen and what he'd lose if he drank again. And on the day in question, he was feeling irritated, and it sounds like he didn't take any action. It sounds like he didn't do a step 10, didn't talk to a fellow, and he was in self-will. And when I'm in self-will, I am completely blocked off from my higher power. So Jim has got absolutely no defense whatsoever against that thought that's going to come into his mind about having a drink. And it sounds like he made an excuse to be where alcohol was served when he wasn't in fit spiritual condition. He could have probably sold a car anywhere, but he decides to go to this particular place to get something to eat. And there happened to be a bar. So he made an excuse to be where alcohol was served when he wasn't in fit spiritual condition. My example of that would be sitting in a cafe all day drinking coffee. If I'm not in fit spiritual condition, I'm probably going to pick up one of my alcoholic foods that's served in a cafe before the day is out. And the problem is that we never know when the thought to pick up our alcoholic foods will come. And that is why spiritual connection and growth is so important. And the delusion that he would be okay, you know, I can never trust my own thinking because my mind is the problem. And it points out in the section in italics, suddenly the thought crossed my mind. It doesn't say gradually, so it doesn't give me time to phone my sponsor or speak to somebody else. It's a sudden thought. And if I'm not spiritually connected, the chances are that I am going to pick up my alcoholic foods. And then on page 37, it gives the example of the jaywalker. And I thought this was a pretty ridiculous example to do with compulsive overeating when I first read it, until I thought about it a little bit differently. And I substituted for jaywalking and what happens when he's breaking his arms and his back and his neck and et cetera, et cetera. I substituted that for damaging my health with compulsive overeating and it affecting my blood sugar. And I absolutely know there are many reasons why people become diabetic. It's not necessarily related to compulsive overeating, but I was just using this as an example. So if I read the jaywalker story, and I apply that, I layer on, an experience of a compulsive overeater. My behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to that first bite of that as an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. So he gets the thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles, and he enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. So, the food worked for me. I loved going out, eating socially. I was having a great time with food. But I was gaining weight, and people were telling me that I was damaging my health through compulsive overeating. The doctors were saying I had two pregnancies while I was compulsively overeating. You're putting too much weight on. You need to watch what you're eating. So I start to damage my health with compulsive overeating. That's what I'm told. I'm warned about that. So up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him and he's slightly injured several times in succession. So my blood sugar starts to rise. I'm carrying on compulsively overeating. Sugar is my primary binge food. So my blood sugar starts to rise. You would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. So you would expect me, if I was normal, the doctor's saying to Miguel, your blood sugar's going up, you need to stop eating sugar. If I were normal, I would stop it because I really value my health. But it says presently he's hit again, and this time he has a fractured skull. So my blood sugar's rising and I need to start taking tablets for my diabetes, and I'm on medication. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. So I carry on compulsively overeating, and by this time, I need to start taking insulin injections. So he says that he decided to stop jaywalking for good, but in a few weeks, he breaks both his legs. I need double the insulin dosage to regulate my blood sugar. On through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or keep off the streets altogether. I'm going to start a diet tomorrow. I'm going to stop compulsively overeating. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce and he's held up to ridicule. So I have all of these consequences from my compulsive overeating. And I try every known means to get the idea out of my head. I shut myself up in an asylum. I go on some health retreat, trying to mend my ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. My equivalent would be I end up in a diabetic coma. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? So you may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substituted compulsive overeating for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where food has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? And again, that describes my step one experience. And there is a sentence on page 107 that asks, what had become of their judgment, their common sense, their willpower? Why could they not see that drink meant ruin to them? So, I had really good judgment in certain areas of my life. I had a lot of common sense. I had a lot of willpower. I had a reputation at work that if there was a really tricky problem, give it to Gail because she'll be able to sort it out. So I had a lot of power. There were lots of things that I could do, but when it came to food, it just brought me to my knees time and time again. And, it says, why could they not see that certain foods meant ruin to them? I could see that, but I was just powerless over it. And I knew exactly what was going to happen to me when I indulged in those behaviors and in those foods, but I was completely powerless to do anything about it. And on page 39, it says, but the actual or potential compulsive overeater, so no matter where we are on the scale, whether we are an actual or, we're a potential compulsive overeater, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop compulsively overeating on the basis of self-knowledge? And again, a really good question is that your experience? You know, has self-knowledge worked for you? Do you really truly get that you are going to be unable to stop compulsively overeating based on self-knowledge? You know, I could have written a book about my experience and what happened to me with certain foods, but that self-knowledge did not serve me at all because I literally could not stop. Again, linking it back to because I was overeating to overcome a craving beyond my mental control. So Gail was never going to be able to fix this. And I know that today because there is no explanation for how I am sat here today, not compulsively overeating, half the person I was from a weight perspective. There is no logical explanation for that because I had 20 plus years of trying to sort this problem out myself. The thing that's happened to me is that my sponsor took my hand and she took me through these steps and she put my hand, these steps put my hand in the hand of a higher power that does for me every single day what I can't do for myself, providing I follow these instructions. And my relapse showed what happens when I don't follow these instructions. And unfortunately, I could only see that in the rearview mirror because when I was going into relapse, there was lots of things happening that I couldn't see. And although I had a sponsor, I wasn't availing myself of good sponsorship. I wasn't using my sponsor like I use my sponsor today. I was very flaky around my evening reviews, around my step 10s. I wasn't telling her everything that was going on. I wasn't committing my food. So I was being very, very flaky and following these instructions. And it was like standing on the edge of a cliff in fog, I couldn't see that I was going to fall off. And what happened to me when I came into recovery, I put the food down, I started to stabilize emotionally, and I connected spiritually. That's what happened with my recovery. The food went down first, I started to work the steps and got emotionally stable and developed and grew this spiritual connection. But what happened to me in relapse was the flip of that. So I disconnected spiritually, as we've just seen in these stories. I became emotionally unstable, and the last thing to go was the food. And all the warning signs were there. I've done a number of workshops on relapse, and all the warning signs were there, and I couldn't see them. And nobody was holding a mirror up because I wasn't telling people what was going on. And my experience in this recovery is really, really different because I understand the importance of following these instructions. I understand the importance of doing an evening review every night before I go to bed and sharing it with my sponsor. I understand the importance of committing my food because if I don't commit my food, I start to think, oh, I don't fancy that for my lunch. It's really cold. I don't want something that's cold. I want something nice and warm. That's what my head does. Whereas if I've committed my food, I just think, Gail, that's what you've said you're going to eat. Just eat it. Stop debating. Just eat your lunch. Get over it. End of story. So if I'm not taking those actions, then I am risking my recovery. And you know, I've had an experience recently with my morning routine. So I just kind of fascinate myself. So I would never ever go to bed without doing my evening review. I do it every single night and share it with my sponsor. But talk to me about my morning routine. Much less reliable. Lots of times, you know, I'll just press the snooze button for 10 minutes and think, oh, I'll just have another 10 minutes. I'm really, really tired. And then I do it again. And then I'm just saying a quick prayer as I get into the shower. That's not going to cut it because that's not following the instructions in this book. And I just think, how can I know that I have to follow the instructions before I go to bed? And yet, I'm debating the instructions in the morning and thinking I don't need to do that. And then I had an experience, it's probably about 7 weeks ago now, where a fellow who's been in OA for many, 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 many years wrote a blog on their Step 11 morning practice. And it has completely revolutionized how I do my morning routine because what I realized I was lacking was some structure. And this fellow shared the structure and something has just happened that I willingly get up an hour before my day starts, and do my morning routine. And it's just positively impacted on my recovery so much. It's incredible, but I have literally kind of pushed back against that, my morning routine. And sometimes I've done it, sometimes I haven't. So, I don't do any of this perfectly, but that's the sorts of things that my mind can do to me. And even in recovery, I absolutely know the pitfalls of relapse, and yet I'll still balk at following some of the instructions. And that just shows the kind of size of my ego and my arrogance that I think, well, I'll be all right not doing this. It's just crazy. Absolutely kind of crazy, crazy mind. So yeah, I can have judgment, I can have common sense, I can have willpower, but when it comes to food and this disease, I have to completely rely on my higher power. It says somewhere in the book that we are undisciplined, so we ask God to discipline us. I am really undisciplined. Without God's help, I can't consistently do my morning routine. I can't consistently take my vitamin tablets, and I can't drink enough water. Those are really, really simple things that I just can't do unless I rely on my higher power. So yeah, knowing about myself, knowing what I'm like is not enough for me to stay in recovery. And then the final story in this section is Fred. And again, Fred's story contains some really valuable lessons. Fred really wanted to stop, and it didn't occur to him that on his own power he couldn't. You've shared that in what you've been sharing back with me. You think you can stop and you can't. He's still in the delusion of self. I can fix this. I can control it. I've got this. Next time will be different. And he didn't believe he was an alcoholic, and he didn't accept that he needed a spiritual solution. His ego was telling him he was different, like my ego says, oh, you'll get away with not doing your morning routine, it's fine. And Fred had lots of success in sorting other problems out, and I think that's a real challenge. Lots of us are really, really capable in lots of areas of our lives. So it's really difficult for us to surrender to the fact that, we can't do this and we need a spiritual solution. And, it was a perfect day, and I, as I've said, I didn't only binge on days when I was struggling, I also binged to intensify feelings of joy. And here's Fred, not a cloud on the horizon. He's having a perfect day. And then the thought came to mind, just like Jim, we never know when that thought will come. And the consequences of picking up that first bite are not enough to stop me. And I know today that I will end up back in the food if I don't stay spiritually connected, if I am a real compulsive overeater. Because of the mental blank spot, I can't rely on my own mind to keep me safe. And Fred has to let go of what he thinks he knows. And page 43 just describes me to a T. I am 100% hopeless apart from divine help. Is that me? Is that you? Are you 100% hopeless apart from divine help? And then it says on the bottom of page 43, Gail at certain times has no effective mental defense against that first bite, except in a few rare cases. Gail or any other human being can provide such a defense. Gail's defense must come from a higher power. And that then takes us into step two, which starts to describe how we connect with that power. And I think it's really interesting that out of 164 pages, step one takes up 43 of those pages, plus the doctor's opinion, to convince us that we are powerless and our lives are unmanageable because our denial and delusion can be so strong. So the vast majority of the book is focused on step one, 43 pages, plus the doctor's opinion out of 164, because we need that much convincing that we are real compulsive overeaters, we are powerless. We can't do this. Nobody can do it for us. There's only connecting with a power can do it for us. So again, let's take some time just to kind of reflect on your own experience. So again, I was asked to look at three areas. Does my experience show that I never know when the thought to compulsively overeat will come? Am I holding on to thoughts that I can still control my eating? And do I truly know that I am hopeless apart from divine help? And if you're sharing on that question, just think about, just share your experience, strength, and hope on that. How do you know that you are hopeless apart from divine help? So we'll just take a few minutes, for you to jot down some points about those questions. Thank you.